We haven't done one of these for a while.
It's been a while.
So we're now in what I would conceptualize as season two.
Season two.
Still don't have a name, second season.
Exactly. Per tradition.
Yes.
Per tradition.
I think I said at some point that the thought that I had was that it would be kind of like, remember Hot Shots Part Deux, where where the planes were labeled the Navy in the U.S. Navy font, and so they weren't from they weren't from the U.S. Navy; they were just the Navy. And so I thought maybe it could just be the podcast,
The podcast which must not be named.
The Scottish podcast.
The Scottish. Oh, I like that. The Scottish podcast.
There is no true Scottish podcast.
Actually, we're not drinking this evening, and so no true Scottish podcast will be drinking alcohol. Oh, we can?
Yeah.
I take it you'll be okay with this?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. As we're recording this, I'm still actually physically shaking a little because this is right after, for posterity, right after Justice Scalia's passing was announced. And so we are kind of all in a new era. I think it's safe to say that I would not be who I am today, and I certainly wouldn't be a Catholic but for Justice Scalia. I think that the intellectual tool set that I learned from him has taken me on a journey in terms of my political and legal interests, but also applying that to religious questions has a lot to do with why I ended up. Thank you, sir.
No problem. And what's left, I'll leave.
Thank you.
With you.
So, you have a story about a moment that turned you towards Scalia's point of view, right?
Sort of.
Yeah.
I want to say it was January 2005. And Scalia and Breyer were doing kind of a debate at American University on the subject of foreign law in American courts. And if memory serves, beknownst to them but not beknownst to us, this was a question that was active in, I think it was Lawrence against Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that Scalia said made a lot of sense and was well presented and was appealing. And Breyer, much as he just is, was kind of mushy and talked around the issue and didn't seem in any way appealing. So that kind of set me down the road toward... it really kind of changed the orientation of what I was reading and studying away from politics and towards law, and kind of galvanized me towards originalism. And the kind of the outlook on how you approach texts and the kind of questions you ask and what you're looking for really all kind of came from that original impulse. And so then when I started looking at religious stuff more seriously, naturally religion is a system, or Christianity at least, is a system now functionally built on texts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question, well, okay, I have a system for what I do with texts, so let's run those texts through this. And you start to, and that didn't just come from him. I mean, that legal prism meant that, of course, I want to know what the fathers of the church said about it for the same reason that I want to know what John Marshall said about something. Mm-hmm. You're not just going to take a text that's very old and start from scratch with it. You want to know what everyone else has said about it on the way. And, it's probably not true that everyone who reads the church fathers becomes a Catholic or Orthodox. I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of evangelicals who know the Church Fathers very well and nevertheless are not Catholics. But certainly for me, that was it was difficult to imagine not being a Catholic after reading in the Church Fathers. That you really see the Church in ovo in all of those writings, I think.
So, would you say that your conversion to originalism happened first?
Yes. By several years. I mean, I already had a functioning philosophy of I was going to say the functioning philosophy of law, but the point is that it's really a functioning philosophy of how you read texts and what you do with texts that really all came from Justice Scalia and Judge Easterbrook, Judge Sykes, people like this, that was then in place and ready to act as a filter when I started looking at religious questions.
And it's so interesting because, you know, Justice Scalia is pretty much the end result of 2,000 years of legal and Catholic religious tradition.
Yeah.
You know, our legal system owes much to canon law and this early Christian tradition. And so here you are coming in the opposite way.
Yeah.
First into a legal tradition and then into the religious tradition.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Much appreciated. So yeah, it's it was it had just a monumental effect on how I think about things and the kinds of questions I'm interested in, the kind of answers that I'm looking for, and yeah, and he was a fellow traditionalist Catholic as well, for those counting. So you can't quite see, you know, Justice Scalia with a kind of, you know, cinder block church and frosted glass windows going, Gloria, Gloria.
No, yeah.
Thank you, Sister Connie.
It's a shame thinking about, because I just can't help thinking right now, all of the nasty things that are going to be said about the late Justice Scalia.
That are already being said.
Yeah, already being said. I'm sure there's horrible memes being posted and gleeful cackles coming from all sorts of places.
Boy, I'm just so sorry to be off Facebook for Lent.
That's, yeah.
It's just a terrible time to be missing that kind of thing.
And, I mean, I know that Scalia doesn't care about that kind of stuff. He didn't then and certainly doesn't now. But it's unfortunately because I think a lot of people intentionally misunderstand Scalia. They think he's a fascist. They think he's a horrible, you know, right-wing ideologue who's just putting forth, you know, twisting things to his designs, rather than understanding that he had a way of looking at things and he applied it whether or not he personally agreed with it. You might not agree with his way of looking at things, but he applied that pretty even-handedly.
Yeah, that was... Journalists would often ask this question as kind of a gotcha-like question because, you know, they say, okay, so you know, when you say, you know, you don't necessarily agree with the results in cases, but it's just where the law goes. Give us an example, you know, other than the flag burning case, you know, other than basically all of the counter examples. Give us an example, and the one that sticks in my memory. Thanks. Is about a, I want to say it was a statute that gave a right of return to children of Indians, that the tribe could basically demand the kid back, and this child had gone out to non-Indian foster parents, and the tribe wanted the child back after several years. And that he thought this was just a monstrous result, but that's what the statute says. But I understand why that criticism comes about, because if one believes a lot of what was said about law in the 20th century by the realists and people like that, that the law is whatever it ought to be, then you are going to just assume that all judges are basically doing that, and anything that they say is just window dressing for doing just that. And so if it's all window dressing, then it's all window dressing and all this guff about determinate meaning, which everyone actually knows to be true. I mean, you know, no one thinks that that text is indeterminate. You know, we all know that there's a range of permissible meaning. You know, you and I may not necessarily agree on what the end of Inception was. You know, what does it portend? Did it start to wiggle a little bit right at the end? But we all, any reasonably competent speaker of English can follow the dialogue in the movie. You know, it's not ambiguous what they're saying for the most part. And so I've never understood this kind of tacit assertion that text does not have a determinate meaning independent of what the author intended or what the listener would like to hear. I mean, it just seems crazy to me.
Welcome to the 20th and 21st right. century.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that really all came about in, funnily enough, both religion and law, and I suppose everything else, all at the same time. I mean, the 20th century's got a lot to answer for.
it does. It seems rather depressing. And because we're starting to see it on the other side now. We expect this from the left.
Mm-hmm.
We expect the left to say, it doesn't matter what it says. This is wrong. Mm-hmm. And so we need to fix it by any means possible and not realize what they're burning down or them not caring what they're burning down.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're starting to see people who are supposedly on the right.
So, well, that's very much what the whole Trump
thing. Yeah, it's the whole Trump thing. It's the, we want to have our turn at this great and horrible weapon.
Yeah, I mean, the, stipulate for sake of our argument everything that we've said about, I shouldn't say that, stipulate for sake of argument everything that the right has said about President Obama's executive orders.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I have some real doubts about a lot of that rhetoric. It seems wildly overheated to me. But say you believe that he's wildly overreaching. The Trump position, not necessarily his, but the people supporting him, seems to be, we're going to take that authority and use it for our own ends.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's illegitimate, it seems to me that the only proper response is to say we are going to put a stop to that. Not that we're going to take up the same weapon and use it as... As you said, this great and terrible weapon, and we're going to use it for our own ends. That just seems illegitimate to me.
Yeah. I keep on coming back to the great play, A Man for All Seasons, in the movie, and where St. Thomas More says that I would give the devil himself the benefit of doubt under law.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you cut down all the laws in England to go after Satan... What's left to stand between you and him?
Yeah, when he turns around. Yeah, there's a line I think he puts in Cardinal Wolsey's mouth when Moore offers to pray on a particular subject, he says, "Well, there's prayer and there's action."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
prayer's all well and good, but now we're going to have action, I suppose. Do you guys foresee anything coming down the? What, how does the next year play out? Because it just seems obvious to me that Barack Obama, who represents the antithesis of everything Justice Scalia believed, cannot appoint his successor. But it's a full year before the next president. And God help us, the next president may well be Donald Trump.
The good news is that Donald Trump would only select the best people.
Yeah.
He would clearly select a class of justice.
Yeah.
Well, that's the first.
You guys super know classy. He would select, like, one of those... There's this Fox News legal analysis lady. Her name's not coming to my mind. And she's a big Trump supporter. And you know he would select, like, her.
Well, anybody who expressed vocal support for him, probably.
Yeah.
Seems like a good candidate for him.
That's what a good national populist does.
Yeah.
Is reward...
Reward personal loyalty.
Well, you know, loyalty. Wasn't there a poll a while back that the large percentage of Americans think Judge Judy is on the Supreme Court? Maybe it would be a classy move to put Judge Judy on.
Wasn't
the
it only like 10% of people?
Yeah,
or something?
It was only 10%, and they did not use the words Judge Judy.
Oh,
they said
Judith Shindlin.
Shindlin. As one of the choices.
I don't think that makes it any better. I know
I think
10% is still 10% too much.
I think it makes it a little bit better.
Does it? Does it really?
It makes it less
people
bad.
People in 1800 knew the Supreme Court justices?
Listen, when you've got a justice whose first name is Bushrod, people are going to know about it.
Yeah, that is true.
When I get a dog, I am totally calling it. If I can't get Sam's advice of calling him the dog Anathema past Vicky, then I want to call it Bushrod.
Anathema.
Walk around the park. Bushrod, sit! But no, I mean, I take your point. And, you know, if you, you put a gun to my head, I couldn't name the, you know, the people sitting on the FEC at the moment. But, you know, I don't think that it's asking a lot to ask the public to remember the names of you know, the Supreme Court, the president, and, you know, the very senior leadership in Congress. I don't think that's asking an awful lot. And I don't think it's like, you're not asking them, you know, who is the, you know, the junior senator from Wyoming. I mean, that's, even the citizenship test doesn't go that far. The citizenship test just asks that you know the Chief Justice, the President, the Vice President, and your own representatives. That seems reasonable enough to me.
Simon, are you suggesting that citizens should be able to pass the citizenship test?
I would suggest that if they can't, then they're doing something wrong. It's a very low bar. I mean, having taken it...
I'm normally in favor of voter apathy. Because
I don't care about voter apathy.
Exactly. Because if you look at countries where we see 85% turnout rate, they're countries like Iraq or Greece. And people are turning out in these numbers because this election is going to determine whether or not we have bread. Here in the United States, we generally have a pretty stable political system, thank God. You know, we have these systems in place and these wonderful checks and balances that, under normal circumstances, the president, it doesn't matter who's in office as much as you think, because the president is limited in his responses, ideally.
Yeah, the other thing, I think, is that most of our political issues are pretty settled. We have a very small spectrum of controversial political issues that are actually in play. And so there's very little room for politicians to impact much at this point.
Is it called is the Overton window the right term for that? There's a term for the range of plausible political positions that are in play at any given time. Is that the right word?
That's an Overton window, yeah.
Yeah, it's just very small for us here in the U.S.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's small.
It's growing. That's the thing.
Yeah, it is getting bigger.
I mean,
because our political consensus is getting tossed out.
Shattering, yeah. Because, as I said, normally I'm in favor of voter apathy. Because I think that's actually is a sign of a healthy political stability. But, of course, you know, we've been seeing since Barack Obama voter engagement actually going up. You know, and then
which post recession is not surprising.
No, not at all. But look at where we are now. You know, we're getting ready. The choices between a reality TV star and a socialist.
I must say, I feel like I'm at a point where I know. So I can't see. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So. Are y'all at least understanding where I usually come from on the whole third party thing now?
No.
Like, are you getting where I'm coming from on third party?
I'm even less sympathetic to the third party thing than I was 3.5 hours ago. I think this demonstrates quite acutely that the bad guys win or the slightly less bad guys win, and that's it. Those are the two choices. Because think about it. Donald Trump, there is no good reason to think that Donald Trump will appoint a worthy successor to Justice Scalia. But there is every reason to think that Bernie Sanders will appoint a successor who is just the worst possible outcome. Right? You know, Bernie Sanders has made very clear that he will do everything possible to further the opposite agenda. And so if you are between rolling the dice or taking a guaranteed punch to the gut, you have to roll the dice.
See, where I'm coming at, I'm not yay third party, but where I'm coming at it is that parties are dead. That's what this is. This isn't third party. I mean, look at both of these candidates and you say, we need tighter party control. These candidates couldn't have gotten where they were 30 years ago. You know, it would have been impossible. But now it doesn't matter. And so we need our old mechanisms for controlling who rises to the highest office in the land are no longer as functional as they were. And so we need to either find ways to restore them or find new mechanisms.
Here then is a Q-like solution, right? You snap your fingers and a white flash of light. The current arrangement of two Big Ten parties is no longer functioning because it's terribly difficult to say what it means to be a Republican or a Democrat, because they don't actually mean anything. The Republican Party was founded to abolish slavery. I think we can say job done on that one. Ta-Nehisi Coates may disagree on that, but, you know. And the Democratic Party was founded, you know, to oppose the Federalist incursions on states' rights. I think we can say mission failed on that one. So, one can imagine this Q-like solution in which you snap your fingers and you move to a new system in which there are parties closer to what you see in Europe and Britain that are organized by an idea rather than in the loosest possible sense, a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have a populist party, which is what, in one way, shape, or form, Trump and Sanders represent. The Ricochet podcast has made, I think, a very astute, I can't remember which of them, I think it was Rob Long, made this very astute suggestion that what unites the Trump and the Sanders people is a feeling that the game is rigged.
Mm.
Yes.
What divides them is what game. Mm-hmm. So the Sanders people think that the economic game is rigged. The Trump people think that the political game is rigged. But, you know, so you could have a populist party, you could have a conservative party, you could have a libertarian party. I know we already have one, but, you know, so you move to this model. The problem is, other than the Q solution, I don't see how you get there from here. I don't know how you do a transition like that.
Not in the United States. Because in the United States, well, for one thing, we've never had a coalition government in our legislature. Our legislature doesn't function that way. If we had multiple parties, it would have to. But that'd be very difficult and tricky just from the ins and outs of the less than written aspects of our Constitution. And then the presidency is not designed to function at all. The whole election of the president isn't designed to function at all that way. If we had three or four major parties, we'd be kicking like every other election to the House.
If memory serves, that was the expectation of how this would function. That the founders, in the strict sense, expected that usually the House would settle elections. I don't know about the founding generation more broadly. I don't know how people read it. But I think that there was an expectation at the convention that this was how elections would often be settled.
But, you know, the American people now wouldn't tolerate that. Not at all. That would just... If we had a legislature deciding, and especially if it was a close election, there'd be... The president wouldn't be able to get anything done because it'd be 4 years, 8 years of calls about bad... You know, of fraud. We saw is the it would be the first time Andrew Jackson ran for president and the so-called corrupt bargain. Imagine that call, except in the world of 24-hour media.
I've actually not done the math. I don't know who would win that election, because the precedents of the House say that each state gets one vote and the state's delegations caucus to decide which way it goes. So you'd have to look at each state's representative count, assume that they function honorably, and award the vote to whichever one has a majority. So, I only assume that California has a numerical Democratic majority of representatives, but it may not.
Because here's the thing, though. We would go more quickly to some sort of I think we're going to see the death of parties. And that's scary.
Right, but that's why I'm driving it with the Q scenario. Right? But how do you... What does that look like?
Well, there's a difference between dividing up into ideological parties and having a whole bunch of quasi-independent, self-labeled candidates who are running on office on personal charisma. And the United States, our system is much better situated to have a whole bunch of independent, self-labeled candidates running on
personal... We have some good checks on demagoguery.
Well, traditionally. But, you know, but I could see, because if it's a winner-take-all, you know, electoral vote system, I don't know, I could see the death of parties. Because the parties have lost, now the most effective way to fundraise isn't through a party. It's through a PAC. Used to be through a party, no longer is. It used to be that we could keep, the parties could keep people in line via pork. But we ended that. And we've seen the mess that John Boehner was left with. And I am going to imagine that every other Speaker of the House is going to have a similar difficulty controlling their members.
So I have a different take on Boehner. I mean, I think Boehner is a good exemplification of what I've said before, that if you make promises in an election, in the broadest possible sense of an election, you had better keep those promises. Mm. Because if you don't, the people who voted against you because they thought those promises were terrible aren't going to like you any better. Mm-hmm. And the people who voted for you because they liked them are going to hate you for betraying them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've never understood why Boehner felt this kind of tug between I can't do what the Republican Party wants, because then the Democrats won't come along on important votes. Well, they weren't going to come along anyway. I mean, it's just fantasy.
It seems to be an older way of functioning. Seems to be a more senatorial mindset as well, but one that, for better or for worse, isn't.
I'm an old fashioned kind of guy, but you know, even as an old fashioned guy, you have to kind of recognize the way that the world is. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be kind of like there's nothing wrong with the word niggardly, right?
Yeah.
But you wouldn't use it if you were ordering at McDonald's. Because no matter how right you may be about its actual provenance and etymology, it's going to be misunderstood, and you've just got to get over it and deal with the world as it actually is. No?
Yeah. Well, I'm just picturing you going to McDonald's and saying that your order of French fries... The French fries is awfully niggardly. It's a niggardly portion.
Yes.
Yeah, I could see that going very well.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I think you might get the special sauce.
Yeah.
Yes, quite. You're saying there's no point in bemoaning, maybe there's a point in bemoaning it, but you have to buckle to the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. And the new reality is that we live in much more partisan times than the version of America that I read about when I was in school, that portrayed America as a much more consensus-driven system in which the parties had much less power, and that everyone was much more independent, and then the current reality, which is just very partisan, mm-hmm. and that's just is how it is, and it's nice if you can get Democrats to come along. But what everyone means when they say compromise tends to be what Barack Obama meant when he was selling Obamacare, which is any Republican who wants to agree with me is welcome to come along. This was on a list of things that I thought about talking about the episode of the podcast after we talked about the Synod. But I've never understood this kind of maniacal need that some people have to compromise, that we have to have some document. We have to all agree on something, and we will water it down until we get to a point at which it says little enough that we can all agree to sign off on it. And that just doesn't strike me as necessarily the best way to go. Surely, you write a text that says something and you have a vote and it passes or it doesn't.
It's a...
Boy, that does sound familiar. Like the passage of Obamacare.
Right, well, and it passed.
Yeah.
But then our friends on the other side will make the argument that it was very much watered down. It's not really what they wanted at all.
No, they wanted something much more robust.
Mm-hmm. But, they did it, and they called the vote, and they pushed it through,
Well, I can think of a few reasons. One is that whenever you have an organization working towards a goal, so whether it be a committee in the Senate or whether it be an interreligious dialogue organization, the organization takes on a life of its own.
Yes.
And so part of it's a sunk cost thing. We spend all of this time working on this. We have to have something, or else we failed. And you don't want to fail. And so it's very difficult to take a step back and say, okay, I've wasted 50 hours on this. Oh, well. It's very difficult to take that. The other thing is that you're not thinking like a politician.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Well, you should. You really should.
One thing is that politicians hold on to power for power's sake. And so if you're a state senator from a Republican state, it's really easy to rail against gun-free zones because that's going to, help you with the NRA and everyone's going to go, yeah! But it's another thing to co-sponsor legislation to outlaw gun-free zones. Because the moment that somebody gets shot inside what used to be a gun-free zone, you are out of a job.
Sure, but this is all very apropos. This is exactly how you get to Trump. Right? You have politicians who keep promising, we're going to do X. And voters say, yeah, go do X. And some of them say, no, don't do X. That's a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. But the majority say, yeah, go do X. And so the politician gets reelected. And then the politician does nothing. And the people who said, yeah, go do X, feel betrayed because X never gets done. And people start to feel, the system doesn't work. Where it becomes really dangerous is where you have it on both sides. So you now have Democrats who feel like they keep winning elections and they keep sending their people to go get things done and nothing happens. And Republicans probably more justifiably keep feeling that they keep winning elections and they keep sending people to get stuff done and nothing gets done. And so inevitably they start feeling, maybe we just need to blow this whole thing up. And they start looking for someone like Trump who is going to go in and turn over the furniture.
Right. It goes back to your point about them thinking the game is rigged.
Yeah.
And I tend to agree with them that the game is rigged. Some of that rigging is good. Some of it's not.
It is life.
Yeah. And again, some of that rigging is good. Some of it's not.
What's an example of good rigging?
So, for example, good rigging might be using pork to control a party, to keep the party in line. That's rigging, clearly. But it might be useful rigging. It might actually
Useful better than good.
Yeah,
useful.
It might actually prevent something worse.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have rigging that actually has a use to it. And then you can have other kinds of rigging, like, say, being able to vote yourself a raise whenever you feel like it. Not so good. That's the kind of rigging I would be very against. I'm a little more ambivalent about the party control. But it is rigged, one way or the other. So I'm quite in agreement with, this is going to be weird for me to say, I'm quite in agreement with Trump supporters and with Sanders supporters that the games are rigged. The games they're talking about are, in fact, rigged to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
They're not wrong about that. Where I think they're failing to really think this through is, to what extent is the rigging a bad thing?
Right.
And to what extent does that rigging actually have a causal relationship to what I'm experiencing that's not good for me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a third layer I would add to that, which is that what are we proposing to do about it?
Drink more beer.
Drink more beer, that's right. I mean, the point has been made elsewhere. I can't remember if this is a Ricochet thing or if this is a Kevin Williams and Williamson and Charlie Cook thing, that the diagnosis that the Trump people have is pretty much correct. They've correctly diagnosed the problem. The problem is that the solution, voting for Trump, is wildly inconsistent with the problem that they're diagnosing. But this gets into a different bit of business, and maybe we should just do this. So maybe we need to grasp the nettle and say that we, so certainly Mike and I, and maybe you as well, all call Trump wrong. And so maybe we should talk about what went wrong in the way that we were thinking about this, because it now seems pretty clear that, at least to me, and maybe you disagree, that despite our assumption, and I think it was an assumption, that eventually he would say something just stupid enough to end his campaign, there's now no possibility that he can say anything that will cause him to end the race with less than 30% of the delegates. That sound about right?
Yeah. Because, I mean, he's literally said that he could kill someone and still win.
And he's right.
And he made that a compliment to his supporters, by the way.
Yeah.
That his supporters were so great that they would still follow him if he went out and just randomly shot someone.
So
I'm not entirely sure as to how he thought that was a compliment or why people took that as a compliment about themselves, but it nonetheless worked.
My theory as to what went wrong with Trump is that he received too much free advertising early in his campaign. Normally, whenever you have joke candidates, they'll receive some attention, but not 24/7 news coverage. But Trump knew how to play this and play it well. He antagonized the media, so the media would cover him more.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the constant coverage...
And they are so, so willing to step right into that trap and say, thank you, Mr. Trump, for providing this excellent gold-plated trap.
Yeah, and not only that, they give him some of the platforms. It wasn't his idea that Muslims should be registered.
But he was going with it.
Yeah.
He rolled with it.
It was... A news guy came up with the idea as something outrageous for him to deny or embrace, and he embraced it. And what do you know? His poll numbers go up. So I think he reached critical mass because of the constant news coverage. And by that point, it was, you know, he became unstoppable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one interesting piece that I read on Politico suggests that his support is not capped where it is, which I thought was interesting. Because the particular person who did the polling to try to figure out what was driving the Trump movement found that there was a statistically significant correlation, far higher than anything else, with authoritarianism and voting for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things he says in that article is that there are far more authoritarians, both among Democrats and Republicans, than are currently voting for Trump. Mm-hmm. Right? So he has room to move up. He has room to move down, too. But he has room to move up, potentially. Which is, I think, not something anybody was calling 6 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to assume that the ceiling on Donald Trump's numbers is 51% of the entire electorate. I think that he wins the general election. I think either Cruz or Trump wins, because Sanders, as Mike has pointed out before, socialism always used to in America poll about the same as Ebola. And Sanders is an outspoken socialist. And Hillary Clinton, on a good day, is an inch from being indicted. I think there's probably something to what I think it was Monica Crowley was saying on Ricochet a couple of weeks ago, that the most plausible scenario is both Sanders and Clinton flame out and Joe Biden is parachuted in at the convention, if not later, or possibly Elizabeth Warren, or possibly both. But I just don't... I have a hard time imagining if it is Sanders or Clinton. I can't see them beating Cruz or Trump. And so to me, this is no longer a conversation about who can win in the fall. It's a question of who's going to be the president of the United States, and to bring it full circle, who's going to appoint Justice Scalia's replacement. It certainly isn't going to be Barack Obama. Yeah.
By the way, before we go any further, let's have a drink to Justice Scalia.
Justice Scalia. So say we all.
Yeah. And what are you drinking, gentlemen? Or in Mike's case, have you already drunk?
Well, I was drinking... What did I have? I had a Samuel Smith's...
Nut Brown Ale is
what you had. Nut Brown Ale. It was very good. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, their Nut Brown Ale is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. I was drinking a Samuel Smith's India Ale. And I'm trying to figure out if this is Brighton Pavilion or something actually in India on the label. But either way, it's a very good India Pale Ale, and you have at last succumbed, since we last podcasted, to the joys and virtues of the British system of the pint as the correct measurement for all beer-related purposes.
For beer-related purposes, yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. It is the perfect size. I can have one beer, be very happy with one beer with the British pint.
I'm into that.
Yeah, whereas with the smaller 12-ounce option here in the U.S., I feel like I need just a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Not a whole other beer, but just a bit more.
And conversely, when I've done home brewing with the 32-ounce bottles, which look like they should be fired out of the sharp head of a battleship, it's just too much, you know? It seems a weird thing to say, I know, but it just kind of invites you on to... You're either drinking too much for an evening, or just inviting your way into a good weekend. So
yeah.
The pint is the perfect amount.
It is, and the pint that I'm having right now is
most things British, it's perfect.
Yes. Billy no confirmation Piper. Bias was harmed David during Tent. The making of this commercial.
That's right.
So I've been having a pint of Samuel Smith's Imperial Stout. Which is apparently quite appreciated in Russia.
Really?
And if the Russians like an imperial stout, that's usually a good sign.
Mm.
It means it's strong and bold, like Vladimir Putin, no
that's
doubt.
That's right. Is this turning into one of those ricochet endorsements where you're going to segue into an endorsement for Vladimir Putin?
No. No, I actually would probably punch the guy if I met him.
Yeah.
It's a bold move.
It is, but God, I'm a bold man.
I am probably of the three of us by far the most Putin inclined. So,
yeah, I will say this: he is often unfairly maligned. And also quite often fairly maligned.
I was going to say, yeah. You know, I don't think that anyone's not got his number at this point. I mean, it's quite clear that his goal is to make Russia great again.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I actually, when he endorsed Donald Trump,
yeah,
I thought, I kind of expected that. Like, that wasn't surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like, I could see that being Vladimir Putin's pick.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's actually trolling at this point.
I don't think he is. I think he actually likes Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he sees Trump as somebody he could make a deal with.
Any common values.
He could, yeah. I mean, Trump would give him the Middle East in exchange for letting us have the oil there or something like that, or build a classy casino.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Classy casino, you know, all the bacon you can eat.
Yeah.
That sounds like Trump.
It would certainly be a singular post-presidency, wouldn't it? I mean, we might be looking at allegations of corruption unlike anything we've seen since Andrew Jackson. I mean, take that entertain that seriously. I mean, so, you know, Trump wins this fall.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to February 2021. What does former President Trump do? Because If he wins, I would prophesy that he will only serve one term, because I think he's going to be miserable. He's not going to enjoy it once he actually gets there and realizes what the job actually entails.
It's not a good job for him.
I will say, and you know, on the record, that if he promises to move the capital to Lincoln, Nebraska, then I will vote for him without any concerns or hesitation. But I think that if he actually did that, he'd be really unhappy.
I think he'd move the capital to, like, Las Vegas or Atlantic City.
I'm holding firm for Lincoln, Nebraska.
And I think that's more his style.
Don't you think Atlantic City would be a bit of a gamble?
Very classy joke.
In his post-presidency...
Well, I mean, he did kind of fail pretty big there.
What he's going to do is he's going to build his presidential library. It's going to look
just... It's going to be huge.
Well, it's going to be huge. It's going to look just like the White House, except like three times bigger.
And there has to be more gold.
Well, yeah. Like a gold-plated White House at three times scale.
As you walk into the president, it's going to... The entire inside, as you walk into the presidential library, there's going to be nickel slots. And so it's going to be the only presidential... He's going to design it to be fully self-funding within 5 years, but it's going to go bankrupt. That's what he's going to do in his post-presidency.
Yeah, I don't see him taking up painting.
No.
I don't think he's a George W. Bush kind of guy.
No.
Well, rolling back to the current year, I wanted to suggest that it seems to me that we're now in a position where it can play out one of two ways. Either everyone gets out and gets behind Cruz pretty quick, like this side of Super Tuesday, or we're going to a brokered convention where Trump, Cruz, and Rubio go in into the convention with 30% each, and Jeb goes in with 10%. Because, well, Jeb is too vain to get out, and Rubio...
He has the super delegates. He also has too much money and too much support.
He can afford to continue in his delusion all the way down the line. And
but so the Republicans don't have superdelegates. Democrats do.
They all not have superdelegates?
No, we don't have superdelegates. We're more democratic.
I'm not surprised.
Is there some weird system in which you're suggesting that even though Bernie Sanders functionally won Iowa and actually won New Hampshire, that Hillary Clinton might in some way be ahead of him in the delegate count? Weird.
Yeah, look, the political game is not rigged, though. It's totally the economic game.
Yeah.
That's rigged. Yeah. No, there's no rigging there in the Democratic Party.
A good conversation to have with a Hillary supporter. Or better yet, a Bernie supporter.
Yeah.
You feeling the burn now, guys? You won twice.
You know, in all seriousness, I fully expect that a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters will be feeling burned.
Yeah.
After this election.
So, do you think if it goes to Hillary via superdelegates, there's going to be riots?
It depends how close it is.
At the convention?
That's the unknowable thing. If it's on the knife point, then I don't think it will be a problem. But if he is consistently winning and there is a pretty good split, if he opens up a lead of a couple of points, 4 points, five, then... Yeah, that's going to be pretty difficult. But I don't know that it'll necessarily play out that way, because you may remember that the last time Hillary Clinton had a failed presidential bid, she was also ahead in the superdelegate count, and then they all defected to Barack Obama. And I could see the same thing happening again.
Yeah.
And if it does, honestly, it may kill her.
Yeah.
I hate to be maudlin, but I mean, I think that it would be terribly hard on her psychologically to lose two nominations in a row, starting from a commanding position, and as soon as there's any realistic alternative to her, everyone runs away. You know, it's hard not to take that personal.
Yeah, yeah, that's, you know, for sure.
It is, especially after you did all the hispandering.
Oh, that's very good.
Oh gosh, that was beautiful.
Was that marketing campaign not just terrible?
Yeah.
Just terrible. I felt I felt bad for my Latino brothers and sisters on that one. I was like, oh, I'm sorry y'all had to go through that.
Yeah. I mean, I could easily see that going through the Indiana caucus again. But I honestly don't know which way that's going to play out. There is this theory out there that that Obama is going to pull the rug out from under her and let her be indicted for the server stuff.
I still think it's possible that Barack Obama might indict her, because from what I've been hearing, the current head of the FBI,
Comey,
has been, there's talks about if the FBI issues a recommendation for indictment and the Justice Department refuses, he might resign in protest along with a whole bunch of other officials. We might have another Friday Night Massacre on our hands. And Comey has threatened to do this before under the Bush administration. He threatened to resign as a result of some NSA program that he thought was illegal.
But we'll see.
Yeah. Could make it very interesting for the Democratic nomination.
Yeah.
Be totally fine. You just appear up there for your coronation, and then you're whisked off by a bunch of FBI agents. It'll be great.
They have trouble catching her, so they fake an announcement that she won the election.
Ouch. That's cold.
So I want to come back to the question I posed before. So I think we can assume that no one's going to drop out. Because the problem is that though everyone is probably correct that if everyone else dropped out, they could be the anti-Trump candidate and win, no one's actually going to drop out. So it seems to me that we're looking at a quite plausible case for a brokered convention, and if that happens, what happens? I mean, for sake of argument, stipulate my numbers, 30, 30, 30, 10. And if you don't like that stipulation, tell me why that's wrong.
My guess is at that point, Rubio and Cruz make a deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, I don't think it's going to be, one's going to be slightly more than the other.
Well, within a fudge of numbers.
Even, and within that fudge of numbers, we'll determine.
Sure. I mean, so if Jeb comes in with 5 and Rubio has 15, mm-hmm. I don't think that fundamentally changes the analysis. I mean, to me, Rubio and Jeb are basically a unit. You know, they are both. And this is exactly the problem, that they're both competing for the same chunk of the electorate, or at least of the Republican primary base, which the Trump and Cruz people dismiss as the establishment, which is kind of silly, but you know the kind of people they mean. You know, they mean the Susan Collins Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
People who think that Olympia Snow is a perfectly nice person at a cocktail party, but kind of conservative. But that's the kind of, they're kind of fishing for respectable Republicans. Not these kinds of wildfire insurgents. And that, to me, divides them fundamentally from the people who are going to be happily backing Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, I mean, it's kind of silly, because Rubio, I think, as everyone has pointed out, has a very conservative voting record. But no one is going to forget that great apostasy on immigration. For good, bad,
where he tried to be bipartisan.
Yeah.
And felt the burn.
Yeah. He got burned, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that he did anything wrong or that he didn't do anything wrong. I take no position on that. But there's a significant chunk of the base that will never forgive him for that and will never get on board, no matter how important it gets. Am I wrong about that?
We'll see how important it gets, and we'll find out.
They might hold their nose and vote for him if they have to, and they will probably hold their nose and vote for Cruz with Rubio as VP.
It depends on what because we say a significant chunk of the base doesn't like him. It depends on what the people who that chunk of the base listens to says. Because we're starting to see, Rush Limbaugh came out recently and said that Rubio is the closest thing to Reagan that we have. And,
that's high praise.
That's high praise. That's very close to the endorsement. Of course, now Rush Limbaugh is turning rather old. Rush Limbaugh's rather old in the talk radio right-wing movement. You know, there's other younger, more shrill voices.
Can really fire up the outrage to 11.
Yeah, yeah.
I find it, on that point, I find it interesting that Cruz just put out a parody video called It's Good to Be a Clinton.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, it's a very sharp satire of the Office Space thing. But as I'm watching it, it occurs to me, man, this thing is just playing into my demographic just perfectly. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm 35. I don't know that our students have even seen Office Space, let alone that they'd get the reference and put the two together. I don't know, maybe the young people are just all in the tank for Bernie, but it just suddenly, in a way that it doesn't usually strike me as, man, this is something that is very specific to a particular age range and demographic that probably, I'm probably on the bottom end of it, and it probably runs up to about 5 years after Cruz. But, you know, if you are older than 50 or younger than 25,
mm-hmm.
that you're probably going to have a quite different, or I could see you having a very different reaction to that than I did and that you did, because it's so specific to a particular age range.
I'm going
to
suggest that there's something good about the fact that most people get their news from secondary sources. Actually, no, farther than that. Maybe quaternary sources.
Yes.
So one of the things that happens with quaternary sources is that they tend to say, oh, this is so awesome. This is the reference, this particular campaign
they
used.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it great how they use this reference? Mm-hmm. And so my suspicion is that the information about the reference is being conveyed to people who are outside of the age group.
Mm-hmm. And the other question you have to ask is, why are they putting this out now? And obviously the answer isn't because it's Cruz versus Clinton, but because he wants you to think it's Cruz versus Clinton.
It's a great narrative for him.
Yeah, it's to fire up us, the Republican voters who are going to be voting, to vote for Cruz because they're angry at Clinton. It's to make that connection.
Well, can I just say it didn't work? not for me anyway.
Well, yeah, not for you. Not
I
for
don't
you.
Think it worked for you either.
You know, Cruz has grown on me. Cruz has grown on me because of his stand on ethanol.
Okay. You're cruising for Cruz a little bit more now, huh?
That makes me... His stand on ethanol makes me say, okay, this is someone who actually really held a unpopular position and won with it.
Well, not only that, but held it at a time where it was not only... where it was politically very inexpedient to do so. This was a must-win campaign. Flip-flopping on ethanol was an easy, gimme thing to win at a must-have time, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't do it.
Yeah, everybody else counted out on
need to do it.
Ethanol.
He's been wooing Iowa for the last couple of years, to my understanding.
I think he did.
I mean, the governor came out against him. That was a huge risk.
Yeah, he would have carried Iowa by a huge margin if he had done that. Huge.
Yeah.
But I think that speaks well of it. And honestly, even if the numbers would have been exactly the same if you reran it, it still takes a degree of political courage to say something deeply unpopular, or at least perceived as deeply unpopular. I don't know if it actually is, but my impression is that
I have no idea what the polling numbers would actually look like on that issue.
Now, I did read something interesting. The way he got away with it in Iowa is because he said he was against the renewable fuel standards, but he also came out and said he was going to... Apparently, the EPA restricts the blending combinations, and so you're only able to blend really high or really low, but not within this medium range. And there's this medium range of blends that opens up engines that are available in Europe. And so he was going to lift the EPA restrictions, which would make those engines available, which would increase the market for ethanol.
Mm.
Which was an interesting strategy.
That's a very sharp line to take.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting.
So, yeah, we will see. We are, what, 2 weeks from South Carolina, and then Super Tuesday's, what, March 3rd?
I think so, right, yeah. So,
well, we will have to do this again after we have more data.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to say to people, anyone who will listen, you know, it's all talk until the votes are really cast, and now the votes are really cast.
Yeah.
It does seem to me that fundamentally it's going to be Trump or Cruz. You know, it's hard to see the math working out any other way. I don't see Rubio, even if Rubio could induce Jeb to drop out, I just don't see it happening. There just isn't enough numbers. There isn't enough juice in all those combined numbers. So it's kind of like when Rand Paul and Rick Santorum and there was a third person, Huckabee, dropped out after Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, well done, you've just moved the needle perhaps 3%.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of people running, but cumulatively, the bottom strata doesn't really count for an awful lot. And so that's just how it seems to me as the race as it stands. On the other hand, we were both wrong about everything last year when it came to Trump. So, you know,
we'll see. I mean, at least we were right that Trump didn't win Iowa.
Yes.
You know, I
it's true, he did.
Yeah.
He finished reasonably strong second.
Yeah, he finished stronger than we'd like, but he didn't win. So we'll see how he plays in South Carolina.
I am very curious to see how he does with Southern voters.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to go as well as he'd imagine.
You want to make a prediction? You confident?
He's not going to win South Carolina.
Who will? Well, all right, let me put it this way. So then, if we assume that Trump can't, then there are two scenarios, two realistic scenarios. Either Cruz wins, or Rubio wins. I mean, I suppose there's a scenario in which Jeb wins, but fundamentally, I think we can rule out Jeb and Casey.
Yeah.
If Cruz wins, I think he's clearly got, at that point, momentum towards being the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
If Rubio wins, then suddenly it's a three-way race again in a way that I don't think it currently is. That sound about right?
Yeah, I agree with that. It's going to be interesting. I'd have to see the latest polls. I haven't seen the latest polls out of South Carolina. Not that we can really trust the polls at all.
Nope, I don't trust the polls, unless it's the polls the day before.
Yeah,
and I trust those a little bit.
I don't think you can trust any polls. I think you can trust trend lines.
Mm.
I found it unfathomable how people spun New Hampshire as being a surprise, when Trump and Sanders have been in commanding lead for months and months and months and months. And it's like, mm-hmm. No individual poll would convince me that this was the case, but you have this trend line that's basically flat,
mm-hmm.
going out over months. In what way is it unpredictable? I mean, it just seems straightforward to me.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised about New Hampshire at all.
I guess my only prediction would be that if Rubio were to pull it out and win South Carolina, then we are definitely going to a brokered convention. Whereas if Trump or Cruz wins, then there's still the possibility that we could settle this like men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pistols at dawn.
Yeah.
Yes, the famous Trump-Cruz debate.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be fun to watch.
Oh, gosh.
My money's on Cruz.
Cruz seems like a man who's fired weapons a lot more often than Trump.
Yeah, my assumption is that Trump has other people fire weapons for him.
He has a butler to fire his gold-plated shotgun.
So. Hell, maybe his wife does it. She looks scrappy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Melania actually, to me, is more compelling than Trump.
Mm.
Really? Go figure.
No, I mean, she actually seems too. Smarter, funnier, and more capable, like, in all seriousness.
Let me tell you, as the one of us that's married, the trick is always to marry a woman who is smarter, more capable, and more appealing. That is the trick, ladies and gentlemen, that's how you do it.
I will keep that in mind, sir. Strong feelings there. We should really address
that. That's going on the cutting room floor.
Is that going to be the name of our episode?
No. Not unless we're endorsing Donald Trump. That's right. And I'm not.